You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores. Think about the last time you had a cancel subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hi, this is Tony Bruschi. You're about to listen to our brand new podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia. Being a brand new show, we need to let other folks know that this thing exists so we can keep doing it. I'd greatly appreciate your help in that effort by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and I'm going to make it worth your while as well. We're going to give away a $200 Amazon gift certificate to one person who left us a review. All you have to do is leave that review on Apple Podcasts, take a screenshot of it, and then send it to me. Send it to review@darksideofwiki.com. So again, to review, leave the review at Apple Podcasts, take the screenshot, and then send it to me. Review@darksideofwiki.com. That's the email address. Review@darksideofwiki.com. Very soon, I'll select one person to get that $200 Amazon gift card as a thank you for leaving that review and letting other folks know we exist. Also, be sure to share us on social media, let your friends and family know, and be sure to press that subscribe button as well as we get another great podcast off the ground. I hope you enjoy The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Sometimes the only way to describe the deplorable actions of a human being is by using the words evil. Actions so twisted, dark, and disturbing, the human mind can barely comprehend them actually taking place. Today, we continue the story of terror rained down on the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the hands of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, The healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
On May 14th, 1990, Dahmer moved out of his grandmother's house and into 924 25th Street, apartment 213, taking Anthony Sears' mummified head and genitals with him. Within 1 week of his moving into his new apartment, Dahmer had killed his sixth victim, Raymond Smith. Smith was a 32-year-old male prostitute who Dahmer lured into apartment 213 with a promise of $50 for sex. At Dahmer's apartment, he gave Smith a drink laced with 7 sleeping pills and then manually strangled him. The following day, Dahmer purchased a Polaroid camera with which he took several pictures of Smith's body in suggestive positions before dismembering him in the bathroom. He boiled the legs, arms, and pelvis into a steel kettle with Soilex, which allowed him to then rinse the bones in his sink. He dissolved the remainder of Smith's skeleton, excluding the skull, in a container filled with acid. Dahmer later spray-painted Smith's skull, which he placed alongside the skull of Anthony Sears, upon a black towel inside a metal filing cabinet. Approximately 1 week after the murder of Raymond Smith, on or around May 27th, Dahmer lured another young man to his apartment. On this occasion, however, Dahmer himself accidentally consumed the drink laden with sedatives intended for consumption by his guest. When he awoke the following day, he discovered his intended victim had stolen several items of his clothing, $300, and a watch. Dahmer never reported this incident to the police, although on May 29th, he divulged to his probation officer that he had been robbed. In June of 1990, Dahmer lured a 27-year-old acquaintance named Edward Smith to his apartment. He drugged and strangled him. On this occasion, rather than immediately acidifying the skeleton or repeating previous processes of bleaching, which had rendered previous victims' skulls brittle, Dahmer placed Smith's skeleton in his freezer for several months in the hope it would not retain moisture. Freezing the skeleton did not remove moisture, and the skeleton of his victim would be acidified several months later. Dahmer accidentally destroyed the skull when he placed it in the oven to dry, a process that caused the skull to explode. Dahmer himself was to later inform police he had felt rotten about Smith's murder, as he had been unable to retain any parts of his body. Less than 3 months after the murder of Smith, Dahmer encountered a 22-year-old Chicago native, Ernest Miller, on the corner of North 27th Street. Miller agreed to accompany Dahmer to his apartment for $50 and further agreed to allow him to listen to his heart and stomach. When Dahmer attempted to perform oral sex upon Miller, he was informed, "That'll cost you extra." Whereupon Dahmer gave his intended victim a drink laced with 2 sleeping pills. On this occasion, he had only 2 sleeping pills to give his victim. Therefore, he killed Miller by slashing his artery with the same knife he used to dissect his victim's bodies. Miller bled to death within minutes. Dahmer then posed the new body for various suggestive Polaroid photographs before placing the body in his bathtub for dismemberment. Dahmer repeatedly kissed and talked to the severed head while he dismembered the remainder of the body. He wrapped Miller's heart, biceps, and portions of flesh from the legs in plastic bags and placed them in the fridge for later consumption. Dahmer boiled the remaining flesh and organs into a jelly-like substance using Soilex, which again enabled him to rinse the flesh off the skeleton, which he intended to retain. To preserve the skeleton, he placed the bones in a light bleach solution for 24 hours before allowing them to dry upon a cloth for 1 week. The severed head was initially placed in the refrigerator before also being stripped of flesh, then painted and coated with enamel. 3 weeks after the murder of Ernest Miller, on September 24th, Dahmer encountered a 22-year-old man named David Thomas at the Grand Avenue Mall and persuaded him to return to his apartment for a few drinks, with additional money on offer if he would pose for photographs. In his statement to police after his arrest, Dahmer stated that after giving Thomas a drink laden with sedatives, he did not feel attracted to him, but was afraid to allow him to awake in case he would be angry over having been drugged. Therefore, he strangled him and dismembered the body, intentionally retaining no body parts whatsoever. He photographed the dismembered process and retained those photographs, which later aided in Thomas's subsequent identification. Following the murder of Damus Thomas, David Thomas, Dahmer did not kill anyone for almost 5 months. Although on a minimum of 5 occasions between October 1990 and February of 1991, he unsuccessfully attempted to lure men to his apartment. He's also known to have regularly complained of feeling of both anxiety and depression to his probation officer throughout 1990, with frequent references to his sexuality, his lifestyle, his financial difficulties. On several occasions, he's also known to have referred to harboring suicidal thoughts. So when you hear stories like this, and obviously we started off on quite the 100 miles an hour graphic tone on this chapter of the Dahmer story, you try and put yourself in, at least I try and put myself kind of in the place and the time of when these things are happening. And you, Sean, by the way, on the episode with us today again, Sean was, this is happening in your town. It was 60 miles south of me, but still a little too close for comfort. I remember being a kid in the truck talking to my dad, listening to WISN radio and WTMJ radio out of Milwaukee, because that's what my dad would listen to all the time. And it was just constant Dahmer updates. And obviously, as these events are unfolding, we don't know they're unfolding till after the fact. But when you hear about these things and you're putting yourself into the perspective of, okay, it's 1990, it's 1991, we're little kids, we're watching TGIF on Friday nights and enjoying pizza and Pepsi. And to think that this shit is going on, with some crazy person, not that far away. I mean, what goes through your mind when you think kind of back in it and that sort of a perspective?
I almost want to take the route of being blissfully ignorant. When I'm watching Family Matters and the beginning intro happens, and then I know I have 2 minutes to run into the kitchen to get another slice of pizza before I get back into the living room and watch it, and not 4 miles away, maybe yeah. 5 miles away from where I grew up, that stuff is happening. Milwaukee, it's a blue collar city. You got a lot of factory workers. You have enough going on. We're looking back on it in 1990. It's not as though people were blind of this. There's a lot going on. It's a pretty sizable city, and sure. It is so interesting. What I took from it is the meticulous details of what he would do. He wouldn't just get a 12-pack of beer and get drunk and go kill a guy and then just go throw their body in a landfill. The details and his processes. Jeffrey Dahmer could have very easily been a very successful chemist for a chemical company and had a very successful life, but just something was just not right. So all of that intelligence and all of that meticulous detail, rather than going this way and living a life of success and prosperity, it went the other way. And yeah. It is, it's very hard to even make sense of it, because you can't, there's really no rationale. You can't understand, oh, well, wow, he's fucked up. I mean, it is so off the beaten path mentally that whether I lived 500 miles away from this mm-hmm. or just down the street, it's just so out there. That fascinating.
What I remember specifically being a kid when these things were going on is, back to the TGIF reference, is you'd be watching TGIF, and in between Family Matters and Perfect Strangers.
Coming up at 10.
Yes, it's exactly what I'm getting to. Coming up at 10.
Stefan, Urkel, Hardee's, and coming up at 10, another skull was found in another freezer.
Details at 10,
But first, your 8-day forecast.
That's a rare condition this day. And you're just like, you're like, your jaws drop like, Mommy, why did they find 7 skulls in that man's freezer on the newspaper page? Nothing can... Well, honey, you know, there's bad people out there. Some people say it's even harder to find. But why is he doing that to those people? Well, there must be some magic through inside. This is how the conversation goes as the intro is playing to Family Matters.
And you think to yourself, looking back on it, when... not Uncle Jesse, but Joey Gladstone.
Yeah.
Cut it out. Has an entirely different meaning.
It changes everything. It really does. Let's continue on with the horrid reality of what Jeffrey Dahmer is. In February 1991, Dahmer observed a 17-year-old named Curtis Strotter standing at a bus stop near Marquette University. According to Dahmer, he lured Strotter into his apartment with an offer of money for posing nude for photos, with the added incentive of sexual intercourse. Dahmer drugged and strangled him with a leather strap, then dismembered him, with Dahmer retaining the youth's skull, hands and genitals, and photographing each stage of the dismemberment process. Less than 2 months later, on April 7th, Dahmer encountered a 19-year-old named Errol Lindsay walking to get a key cut. Lindsay was heterosexual. Dahmer lured Lindsay to his apartment, where he drugged him, drilled a hole in his skull, and poured hydrochloric acid into it. According to Dahmer, Lindsay awoke after his experiment, which Dahmer had conceived in the hope of inducing a permanent, unresistant, submissive state, saying, "I have a headache. What time is it?" In response to this, Dahmer again drugged Lindsay, then strangled him. He decapitated Lindsay and retained his skull. He then flayed Lindsay's body, placing the skin in a solution of cold water and salt for several weeks in the hope of permanently retaining it. Reluctantly, Dahmer disposed of Lindsay's skin when he noted it had become too frayed and brittle. By 1991, fellow residents of the Oxford Apartments had repeatedly complained to the manager of the apartments, Sopa Princewell, of the foul smells emanating from apartment 213, in addition to the sounds of falling objects and the occasional sound of a chainsaw. Princewell did contact Dahmer in response to these complaints on several occasions, although Dahmer initially excused the odors emanating from his apartment as being caused by his freezer breaking, causing the contents to become spoiled. On later occasions, he informed Princewell that the reason for the resurgence of the odor was that several of his tropical fish had recently died, and that he would take care of the matter. On the afternoon of May 26, 1991, Dahmer encountered a 14-year-old named Konarak Synthesum on Wisconsin Avenue. By coincidence, it was the younger brother of the boy whom Dahmer had molested in 1988. He approached the youth with an offer of money to accompany him to his apartment to pose for Polaroid pictures. According to Dahmer, he was initially reluctant to the proposal before changing his mind and accompanying Dahmer to his apartment, where the youth posed for 2 pictures in his underwear before Dahmer drugged him into unconsciousness and performed oral sex on him. On this occasion, Dahmer drilled a single hole into the skull of the man, through which he injected hydrochloric acid into the frontal lobe. Before Synthesum fell unconscious, Dahmer led the boy into his bedroom with the body of a 31-year-old Tony Hughes, whom Dahmer had killed 3 days earlier, lay naked on the floor. According to Dahmer, he believed the boy saw this body, yet did not react to seeing the bloated corpse, likely because of the effects of the sleeping pills he had ingested and the hydrochloric acid Dahmer had injected through his skull. Synthesum soon became unconscious, whereupon Dahmer drank several beers while lying alongside Synthesum before leaving his apartment to drink at the bar and purchase more alcohol. In the early morning hours of May 27th, Dahmer returned towards his apartment to discover Synthesum sitting outside naked on the corner of 25th and State, talking in Lao with three distressed young women standing near him. Dahmer approached the trio and explained to the women that Synthesum, who he referred to by an alias, was his friend and attempted to lead him to his apartment by the arm. The three women dissuaded Dahmer, explaining they had phoned 911. Upon the arrival of two officers named John Belkarak and Joseph Garbish, Dahmer's demeanor relaxed. He informed the officers that Synthesum was his 19-year-old boyfriend, that he had drunk too much following a quarrel, and that he frequently behaved in this manner when intoxicated. The three women were exasperated, and when one of the trio attempted to indicate to one of the officers that Synthesum was bleeding from his buttocks and that he had seemingly struggled against Dahmer's attempts to walk him to his apartment, the officer harshly informed her to butt out, shut the hell up, and to not interfere, adding the incident was domestic. According to the protest of the three women, the officer simply covered Synthesum with a towel and walked him to Dahmer's apartment, where in an effort to verify his claim that he and Synthesum were lovers, Dahmer showed the officers the two semi-nude Polaroid pictures he had taken of the youth the previous evening. The officers later reported having noted a strange scent reminiscent of excrement inside the apartment. This odor emanated from the decomposing body of Hughes. Dahmer stated that to investigate this, one officer simply peeked his head around the bedroom but really didn't take a good look. The officers then left with the departing remark that Dahmer take good care of Synthesum. Had they conducted a background check on Dahmer, it would have revealed that he was a convicted child molester under probation. Upon the departure of the two police officers from his apartment, Dahmer again injected hydrochloric acid into Synthesum's brain. On this second occasion, the injection proved fatal. The following day, May 28th, Dahmer took a day's leave from work to devote himself to the dismemberment of the bodies of Synthesum and Hughes. He retained both victims' skulls. On June 30th, Dahmer traveled to Chicago, where he encountered a 20-year-old named Matt Turner on a bus at a bus station. Turner accepted Dahmer's offer to travel to Milwaukee for professional photo shoots. At Dahmer's apartment, Dahmer drugged, strangled, and dismembered Turner and placed his head and internal organs in separate plastic bags in the freezer. Turner was not reported missing. 5 days later, on July 5th, Dahmer lured 23-year-old Jeremiah Weinberger from a Chicago bar to his apartment on the promise of spending the weekend with him. He drugged Weinberger and twice injected boiling water through his skull, sending him into a coma, for which he died 2 days later. On July 15th, Dahmer encountered 24-year-old Oliver Lacey at the corner of 27th and Kilbourne. Lacey agreed to Dahmer's ruse of posing nude for photographs and accompanied him to his apartment where the pair engaged in tentative sexual activity before Dahmer drugged Lacey. On this occasion, Dahmer intended to prolong the time he spent with Lacey while alive. After unsuccessfully attempting to render Lacey unconscious with chloroform, he phoned his workplace to request a day's absence. This was granted, although the next day he was suspended. After strangling Lacey, Dahmer had sex with the corpse before dismembering him. He placed Lacey's head and heart in the refrigerator and his skeleton in the freezer. 4 days later, on July 19th, Dahmer received word that he was fired. Upon receipt of this news, Dahmer lured 25-year-old Joseph Bradhoft to his apartment. Bradhoft was strangled and left lying in Dahmer's bed covered with a sheet for 2 days. On July 21st, Dahmer removed these sheets to find the head covered in maggots, whereupon he decapitated the body, cleaned the head, and placed it in the refrigerator. He later assified Bradhoft's torso along with those of two other victims killed the previous month. Tonight at 10, after TGIF, the capture of Jeffrey Dahmer, that's what we're finally getting to. What's amazing to me is how long and how many people he was doing these horrible, horrible things to. and how he continued to get people into his apartment and no one really noticing these people necessarily being missing. I mean, a lot of them, you know, probably estranged from their families, but I'm sure there was friends, but no one taking notice to the level that they should have in these communities, saying, what the fuck, where are all these people going? Maybe I was too young at the time to remember, but at the time, did Milwaukee know they had a serial killer on their hands? Were these people being reported missing?
To my knowledge, no. And I also, I mean, I was 8, 9 years old, so we're about the same age. And
yeah,
you feel as though people were totally oblivious to this. But then you think to yourself, how would one know that anything was going on? The majority of his victims, exactly, the Matt Turner reference, he went up to Milwaukee to do a professional photo shoot. He wasn't reported missing. You have all these other people that, I don't know how he selected his victims, but he was very good at reading the room.
Yeah.
Of his victims, of people that were somewhat cast-offs or runaways, or nobody was particularly caring about them, whether they were alive or dead. And looking at it now, in the world we live in with social media and GPS and lost my iPhone apps and this, that, or the other, I also think we have heightened, we're that much more observant, because sadly, in 1990, in 1991, I think we gave people a lot more benefit of the doubt, and they wouldn't do that. Whereas today, sadly, even if you are a good person, people look at you and think, okay, what? This is too good to be true. I don't really think there's a solid answer. And you think the two police officers who didn't do a proper background check? I mean, you have to think, how many times do they encounter situations like that where somebody drinks too much? Hundreds, maybe thousands a year.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found interesting is his victims post those two officers essentially not arresting him. If the families could sue the Milwaukee Police Department, but again, the families didn't even maybe know or care that their sons or brothers were gone.
Yeah.
So it's just fascinating how meticulous I come back to this. Clearly something was clearly wrong with Jeffrey Dahmer, but how he would do this. I mean, it's, it is, an anomaly that I don't think, really anybody knew, what was going on. And I'm just fascinated of what he. How do you inject boiling water into somebody's brain?
I don't know.
YouTube. I don't think the Google was a thing in 1991. No. How do you even come up with this?
Well, wasn't there something to the point, and we'll probably touch on this later in the story, but wasn't he trying to create human zombies? Wasn't that part of, because we did actually touch on it a little bit earlier, and I didn't say zombie, but he was trying to create a person that would be completely submissive to whatever he wanted to do. And in his mind, that would be accomplished somehow by putting the hydrochloric acid and boiling water in someone's brain. Where the fuck that equation equals human zombie, I don't know. But somehow Jeffrey Dahmer thought that was the route to take.
Well, what was interesting is the one victim woke up after he did it. Like, he drilled, took the sleeping pills.
Yeah.
Drilled something into his brain, and he woke up from that. I don't know how that does not kill you from, man, this is next level stuff, that how Jeffrey Dahmer would even have those thoughts in his brain to want to accomplish that, let alone it's fascinating. And it's very easy for us to say, oh, that guy's fucked up, man. But
How do you get from point A to point B is my question. Like, I understand someone who suffered a lot of abuse and fucked up childhood and things like that. You view things differently, and your filter of the world is not going to be super healthy in many cases because of what you suffered. So, and a lot of times it just makes someone be more cautious or tenant or you know, hold back than others and be a lot more scared of people. And it can go other ways too, where it goes to abusive behaviors and you're repeating that abuse. But the thing is with this, it took it to a whole different level. This wasn't just he's going and sexually abusing people. This is like, where the fuck did these ideas come from? That's what I don't understand about the whole case is, okay, I get abusers tend to re-abuse. Not okay, but that is what we see in our world. Where the fuck does this drilling holes in people's head come from? Where is all that? Where, you know, A to B, I get, but like A to F, where he took it, how the fuck did he get there?
He literally must have won an entire set of Encyclopedia Britannicas on Double Dare because he always took the physical challenge. And you know what? He must have read the entire set. Because he has like a fucking owner's manual, not even one owner's manual of, okay, how to kill a person. He's got like 12.
Yeah.
All right. So what are we going to do this time? We're going to do the old chloroform. Oh, that's old hat. Let's step it up a notch. Let's drill a hole into their brain. You know what? We're just going to let them lay on the bed there for a couple of days and marinate. Oh, no. We're going to take their head, put it in the freezer.
Yeah.
No. Put that torso in that pan. It's boiling water. Holy hell. The guy is a chemist. And sadly, rather than using it for the good, what I would love to do is to talk to somebody that was a little older back then, for example, my parents or even my oldest sister, to see how their view of it. Because again, we were 8-9 years old when this went down. If you're, you know, mid-20s, where you are actually have a little bit more understanding of this.
Yeah.
And I may just do that, but, from what it sounds like, this was near the end for his killing escapade.
Let's continue on into July 22nd of 1991. Dahmer approached three men with an offer of $100 to accompany him to his apartment to pose for nude photographs, drink beer, and simply keep him company. One of the trio, 32-year-old Tracy Edwards, agreed to accompany him to his apartment. Upon entering Dahmer's apartment, Edward noted a foul odor and several boxes of hydrochloric acid on the floor, which Dahmer claimed to use for cleaning bricks. After some minor conversation, Edwards responded to Dahmer's request to turn his head and view his tropical fish, whereupon Dahmer placed a handcuff upon his wrist. When Edwards asked what's happening, Dahmer unsuccessfully attempted to cuff his wrists together, then told Edwards to accompany him to the bedroom to pose for nude photos. While inside the bedroom, Edwards noted nude male posters on the wall and that a videotape of The Exorcist 3 was playing. He also noted a blue 57-gallon drum in the corner, which a strong odor emanated. Dahmer then brandished a knife and informed Edwards he intended to take nude pictures of him. In an attempt to appease Dahmer, Edwards unbuttoned his shirt, saying he would allow him to do so if he'd remove the handcuffs and put the knife away. In response to this promise, Dahmer simply turned his attention towards the TV. Edwards observed Dahmer rocking back and forth and chanting before turning his attention back to him. He placed his head on Edwards' chest, listened to his heartbeat, and with the knife pressed against his intended victim, informed Edwards he intended to eat his heart. In continuous attempts to prevent Dahmer from attacking him, Edwards repeated that he was Dahmer's friend and he was not going to run away. Edwards had decided he was going to either jump from a window or run through the unlocked door upon the next available opportunity. When Edwards next stated he needed to use the bathroom, he asked if they could sit with a beer in the living room, where there was air conditioning. Dahmer consented and the pair walked to the living room when Edwards exited the bathroom. Inside the living room, Edwards waited until he observed Dahmer have a momentary lapse of concentration before requesting to use the bathroom again. When Edwards rose from the couch, he noted Dahmer was not holding the handcuffs, whereupon Edwards punched him in the face, knocking Dahmer off balance, and ran out the front door. At 11:30 p.m. on July 22nd, Edwards flagged down two Milwaukee police officers at the corner of North 25th Street. The officers noted Edwards had a handcuff attached to his wrist, whereupon Edwards explained to the officers that a freak had placed the handcuffs upon him and asked if the police could remove them. When the officer's handcuff key failed to fit the brand of handcuffs, Edwards agreed to accompany the officers to the apartment, where Edwards stated he had spent the previous 5 hours before escaping. When the officers and Edwards arrived at the apartment 213, Dahmer invited the trio inside and acknowledged he had indeed placed handcuffs upon Edwards, although he offered no explanation as to why he had done so. At this point, Edwards divulged to the officers that Dahmer had also brandished a large knife upon him and that this had happened in the bedroom. Dahmer made no comment to this revelation, indicating to one of the officers, Rolf Mueller, that the key to the handcuffs was in his bedside dresser in the bedroom. As Mueller entered the bedroom, Dahmer attempted to pass Mueller to himself, retrieve the key, whereupon the second officer present, Robert Roth, informed him to back off. In the bedroom, Mueller noted there was indeed a large knife beneath the bed. He also saw an open drawer, which upon closer inspection contained scores of Polaroid pictures, many of which were of human bodies in various stages of dismemberment. Mueller noted the decor indicated that had been taken in the very apartment in which they were standing. He walked into the living room to show them to his partner, uttering the words, "These are for real?" When Dahmer saw that Mueller was holding several of his Polaroids, he fought with the officers in an effort to resist arrest. The officers quickly overpowered him, cuffed his hands behind his back, and called a second squad car for backup. At this point, Mueller opened the refrigerator to reveal the freshly severed head of a black male in the bottom shelf. As Dahmer lay pinned on the floor beneath Routh, he turned his head towards the officers and muttered the words, "For what I did, I should be dead." More detailed search of the apartment conducted by the Criminal Investigation Bureau revealed a total of 4 severed heads in Dahmer's kitchen. A total of 7 skulls, some painted, some bleached, were found in Dahmer's bedroom and inside a closet. In addition, investigators discovered collected blood drippings upon a tray at the bottom of Dahmer's refrigerator, plus 2 human hearts and a portion of an arm muscle, each wrapped inside plastic bags upon the shelves. In Dahmer's freezer, investigators discovered an entire torso, plus a bag of human organs and flesh stuck to the ice at the bottom. Elsewhere in apartment 213, investigators discovered 2 entire skeletons, a pair of severed hands, 2 severed and preserved penises, a mummified scalp, and in a 57-gallon drum, 3 further dismembered torsos dissolving in an acid solution. A total of 74 Polaroid pictures detailing the dismemberment of Dahmer's victims were found. In reference to the recovery of the body parts and artifacts at 924 North 25th Street, the chief medical examiner later stated, "It was more like dismantling someone's museum than an actual crime scene." Beginning in the early hours of July 23rd, 1991, Dahmer was questioned by Detective Patrick Kennedy as to the murders he had committed and the evidence found at his apartment. Over the following 2 weeks, Kennedy and later Detective Patrick Murphy conducted numerous interviews with Dahmer, which, when combined, totaled over 60 hours. Dahmer waived his right to have a lawyer present throughout his interrogations, adding he wished to confess all, as he had created this horror, and it only makes sense I do everything to put an end to it. He readily admitted to having murdered 16 young men in Wisconsin since 1987, with one further victim, Stephen Hicks, killed in Ohio back in 1978. Most of the victims had been rendered unconscious prior to their murder, although some had died as a result of having acid or boiling water injected into their brain. As he had no memory of the murder of Tommy, he was unsure whether he was unconscious when he was beaten to death, although he did concede it was possible that his viewing the exposed chest of Stephen Tommy while in the drunken stupor may have led him to unsuccessfully attempt to tear Toomey's heart from his chest. Almost all the murders Dahmer committed after moving into the Oxford apartments had involved a ritual of posing the victims' bodies in suggestive positions, typically with the chest thrust outward prior to dismemberment. He readily admitted to performing necrophilia with several of his victims' bodies, including performing sexual acts with their viscera as he dismembered their bodies in the bathtub. having noted that much of the blood pooled inside his victim's chest after death. Dahmer first removed their internal organs, then suspended the torso so the blood drained into his bathtub before dicing any organs he had not wished to retain and paring the flesh from the body. The bones he wished to dispose of were pulverized or acidified with Soilex and bleach solutions used to aid in the preservation of the skeletons and skulls he wished to keep. In addition, he confessed to having consumed the hearts, livers, biceps, and portions of thighs of several victims killed within the previous year. Describing the increase in his rate of killing in the 2 months prior to his arrest, he stated he had been completely swept along with his compulsion to kill, adding, "It was an incessant and never-ending desire to be with someone at whatever cost. Someone good-looking, really nice-looking. It just filled my thoughts all day long." When asked as to why he had preserved a total of 7 skulls and the entire skeletons of 2 victims, Dahmer stated he had been in the process of constructing a private altar of victims' skulls, which he had intended to display on the black table located in his living room, and upon which he had photographed the bodies of many of his victims. The display of skulls was to be adorned at each side with the complete skeletons of Ernest Miller and Oliver Lacey. The 4 severed heads found in his kitchen were to be removed of all the flesh and used in this altar, as was the skull of at least 1 future victim. Incense sticks were to be placed at each end of the black table, above which Dahmer intended to place a large blue lamp with extending blue globe lights. The entire construction was to be placed before a window covered with a black opaque shower curtain, in front of which Dahmer intended to sit in a black leather chair. When asked in a November 18, 1991 interview who the altar was dedicated to, Dahmer replied, "Myself. It was a place where I could feel at home." He further described his intended altar as a place for meditation, from where he believed he could draw a sense of power, adding if this, his arrest, had happened 6 months later, that's what they would have found. On July 25, 1991, Dahmer was charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder. By August 22nd, he had been charged with a further 11 murders committed in the state of Wisconsin. On September 14th, investigators in Ohio, having uncovered hundreds of bone fragments in woodland areas behind the address in which Dahmer had confessed to killing his first victim, formally identified 2 molars and a vertebrae with X-ray records of Stephen Mark Hicks. 3 days later, Dahmer was charged by authorities in Ohio with the murder of Stephen Hicks. Dahmer was not charged with the attempted murder of Tracy Edwards, nor with the murder of Stephen Tomey. He was not charged with Tomey's murder because the Milwaukee County District Attorney only brought charges where murder could be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and Dahmer had no memory of actually committing this particular murder, for which no physical evidence of the crime existed. At a scheduled preliminary hearing on January 13, 1992, Dahmer pled guilty but insane to 15 counts of murder. Jeffrey Dahmer's trial began on January 30th, 1992. He was tried in Milwaukee for the 15 counts of first-degree murder before Judge Lawrence Graham. By pleading guilty on January 13th to the charges brought against him, Dahmer had waived his rights to an initial trial to establish guilt. The issue, debated by opposing counsel at Dahmer's trial, was to determine whether he suffered from either a mental or personality disorder. The prosecution claiming that any disorders did not deprive Dahmer of the ability to appreciate the criminality of his conduct, or to deprive him of the ability to resist his impulses. The defense arguing that Dahmer suffered from a mental disease and was driven by obsessions and impulses he was unable to control. Defense experts argued that Dahmer was insane due to his necrophiliac drive, his compulsion to have sexual encounters with corpses. Defense expert Dr. Fred Berlin testified that Dahmer was unable to conform his conduct at the time that he committed the crimes because he was suffering from paraphilia, or more specifically, necrophilia. Dr. Judith Becker, a professor of psychiatry and psychology, was the second expert witness for the defense. Becker also diagnosed Dahmer with necrophilia. The final defense expert to testify, forensic psychiatrist Dr. Carl Wallstorm, diagnosed Dahmer with borderline personality disorder, schizophrenia, personality disorder, necrophilia, alcohol dependence, and a psychotic disorder.
The prosecution rejected the defense's argument that Dahmer was insane. Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Philip Renzik testified that Dahmer did not suffer from primary necrophilia because he preferred live sexual partners, as evidenced by his efforts to create unresistant, submissive sexual partners devoid of rational thought and to whose needs he did not have to cater. Another prosecution expert to testify, Dr. Fred Fostel, testified to his belief that Dahmer was without mental disease or defect at the time that he committed the murders. He described Dahmer as a calculating and cunning individual, able to differentiate between right and wrong with the ability to control his actions. Although Fostel did state his belief that Dahmer suffered from paraphilia, his conclusion was that Dahmer was not a sadist. The final witness to appear for the prosecution, forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz, began his testimony on February 12. Dietz testified that he did not believe Dahmer to be suffering from any mental disease or defect at the time that he committed the crimes, stating, "Dahmer went to great lengths to be alone with his victim and to have no witnesses. He explained that there was ample evidence that Dahmer prepared in advance for each murder. Therefore, his crimes were not impulsive." Although Dietz did concede any acquisition of the paraphilia was not a matter of personal choice, he also stated his belief that Dahmer's habit of becoming intoxicated prior to committing each of the murders was significant, stating that if he had a compulsion to kill, he would not have to drink alcohol. He had to drink alcohol to overcome his inhibition to do the crime, which he would rather not do. Dietz also noted that Dahmer strongly identified with evil and corrupt characters from both Return of the Jedi and The Exorcist 3, particularly the level of power held by these characters. Expounding on the significance of these movies and Dahmer's psyche and many of the murders committed at the Oxford apartments, Dietz explained that Dahmer occasionally viewed scenes from these films before searching for a victim. Dietz diagnosed Dahmer with substance use disorder, paraphilia, and schizotypal personality disorder. Two court-appointed mental health professionals testifying independently of either prosecution or defense were forensic psychiatrist George Palermo and clinical psychologist Samuel Friedman. Palermo stated that the murders were the result of a pent-up aggression within himself. He killed those men because he wanted to kill the source of his homosexual attraction to them. In killing them, he killed what he hated in himself. Palermo concluded that Dahmer was a sexual sadist with antisocial personality disorder, but legally sane. Friedman testified that it was a longing for companionship that caused Dahmer to kill. He stated, "Mr. Dahmer is not psychotic. He spoke kindly of Dahmer, describing him as amiable, pleasant to be with, courteous, with a sense of humor, conventionally handsome and charming in a manner. He was and still is a bright young man." He diagnosed Dahmer with a personality disorder not otherwise specified, featuring borderline obsessive-compulsive and sadistic traits. The trial lasted 2 weeks. On February 14, both counsels delivered their closing arguments to the jury. Each counsel was allowed to speak for 2 hours. Defense attorney Gerald Boyle argued first, repeatedly harking to the testimony of the mental health professionals, almost all of whom had agreed Dahmer was suffering from a mental disease. Boyle argued that Dahmer's compulsive killings had been a result of a sickness he discovered, not chose. Boyle portrayed Dahmer as a desperately lonely and profoundly sick individual, so out of control he could not conform his conduct anymore. Following the defense counsel's 75-minute closing argument, Michael McCann delivered his closing argument for the prosecution, describing Dahmer as a sane man in full control of his actions, who simply strove to avoid detection. McCann argued that the act of murder was committed in hostility, anger, resentment, frustration, or hatred, and that the 15 victims for whom he murdered was tried, died merely to afford Dahmer a period of sexual pleasure. McCann further argued that by pleading guilty, but insane to the charges, Dahmer was seeking to escape responsibility for his crimes. On February 15th, the court reconvened to hear the verdict. Dahmer was ruled to be sane and not suffering from a mental disorder at the time of each of the 15 murders for which he was tried, although in each count, two of the 12 jurors signified their dissent.
On the first two counts, Dahmer was sentenced to life imprisonment plus 10 years, with the remaining 13 counts carrying a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment plus 70 years. The death penalty was not an option for Judge Graham to consider at the penalty phase, as the state of Wisconsin had abolished capital punishment in 1853. Upon hearing of Dahmer's sentencing, his father Lionel and stepmother Sherry requested to be allowed a 10-minute private meeting with their son before he was transferred to the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin, to begin his sentence. The request was granted, and the trio exchanged hugs and well wishes before Dahmer was escorted away to begin his sentence. 3 months after his conviction for 15 murders in Milwaukee, Dahmer was extradited to Ohio to be tried for the murder of his first victim, Stephen Hicks. In a court hearing lasting just 45 minutes, Dahmer again pled guilty to the charges and was sentenced to a 16th term of life imprisonment on May 1, 1992. Upon sentencing, Dahmer was transferred to the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin, for the first year of incarceration. Dahmer was placed in solitary confinement due to concerns for his physical safety should he come into contact with fellow inmates. With Dahmer's consent, after 1 year in solitary confinement, he was transferred to a less secure unit where he was assigned a two-hour daily work detail cleaning the toilet block. Shortly after completing his lengthy confessions in 1991, Dahmer had requested to Detective Patrick Murphy that he be given a copy of the Bible. This request was granted, and Dahmer gradually devoted himself to Christianity and became a born-again Christian. On his father's urging, he also read creationist books from the Institute for Creation Research. In May 1994, Dahmer was baptized by Roy Ratcliffe, a minister in the Church of Christ and a graduate of Oklahoma Christian University, in the prison whirlpool. Following his baptism, Ratcliffe visited Dahmer on a weekly basis up until November 1994. Dahmer and Ratcliffe regularly discussed the prospect of death, and Dahmer questioned whether he was sinning against God by continuing to live. Referring to his crimes in a 1994 interview with Stone Phillips on Dateline NBC, Dahmer had stated, "If a person doesn't think that there is a God to be accountable to, then what's the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it within acceptable ranges?" And so I thought, anyway. In July 1994, a fellow inmate, Oswald Durote, attempted to slash Dahmer's throat with a razor embedded in a toothbrush as Dahmer returned to his cell from Roy Ratcliffe's weekly church service conducted in the prison chapel. Dahmer received superficial wounds and was not seriously hurt in this incident. According to Dahmer's family, he had long been ready to die and accepted any punishment which might endure in prison. In addition to his father and stepmother maintaining regular contact, Dahmer's mother, Joyce, also maintained regular contact with her son, although prior to his arrest, the two had not seen each other since Christmas of 1983. Joyce Dahmer related that in her weekly phone calls, whenever she expressed concerns for her son's physical well-being, Dahmer responded with comments to the effect of, "It doesn't matter, Mom. I don't care if something happens to me." On the morning of November 28, 1994, Dahmer left his cell to conduct his assigned work detail. Accompanying him were two fellow inmates, Jesse Anderson and Christopher Scarva. The trio was left unsupervised in the showers of the prison gym for approximately 20 minutes. At approximately 8:10 a.m., Dahmer was discovered on the floor of the bathroom of the gym, suffering from extreme head and facial wounds. He'd been severely bludgeoned about the head and face with a 20-inch metal bar. His head had also been repeatedly struck against the wall in the assault. Although Dahmer was still alive and was rushed to a nearby hospital, he was pronounced dead 1 hour later. Anderson had also been beaten with the same instrument and died 2 days later from his wounds. Scarver, who was serving a life sentence for a murder committed in 1990, informed authorities he had first attacked Dahmer with a metal bar as he, Dahmer, was cleaning a staff locker room before attacking Anderson as he cleaned an inmate locker room. According to Scarver, Dahmer did not yell or make any noise as he was attacked. Immediately after attacking both men, Scarver, who was thought to be schizophrenic, returned to his cell and informed a prison guard, "God told me to do it. Jesse Anderson and Jeffrey Dahmer are dead." Scarver was adamant he had not planned the attacks in advance, although he later divulged to investigators he had concealed a 20-inch iron bar used to kill both men in his clothing shortly before the killings. Upon learning of his death, Dahmer's mother, Joyce Flint, responded angrily to the media, "Now is everybody happy? Now that he's bludgeoned to death, is that good enough for everybody?" The response of the families of Dahmer's victims was mixed, although it appears most were pleased with his death. The district attorney who prosecuted Dahmer cautioned against turning Scarver into a folk hero, noting that Dahmer's death was still murder. On May 15, 1995, Scarver was sentenced to two additional terms of life imprisonment for the murders of Dahmer and Anderson. Although Scarver had confessed in 1994 to having concealed the weapon used to kill Dahmer and Anderson in his clothing on the morning of the murders in 2015, he publicly stated the murders of Dahmer and Anderson had resulted from a confrontation in which one of the two men had poked him in the back as the three had begun their assigned work detail. In this renewed account of the event, Scarver claimed that the two had laughed at him when he had turned around in response before Dahmer and Anderson each walked to separate rooms to begin their cleaning duty, with Scarver following Dahmer towards the staff locker room. Scarver alleges that immediately before murdering Dahmer, he had cornered him, presented a newspaper article detailing Dahmer's crimes, and demanded that Dahmer answer whether the account was true. Scarver further alleges he had been revolted by Dahmer's crimes and that Dahmer had been openly unrepentant, that Dahmer taunted prison employees and fellow inmates by shaping his prison food into imitations of severed limbs, complete with ketchup, to simulate blood splattering, and that prison staff, knowing of Scarver's hatred for Dahmer, had deliberately left the two men unsupervised so that he could kill him. Furthermore, Scarver stated that Dahmer was so disliked by fellow inmates that he required a personal escort of at least one guard whenever he was out of his cell to prevent inmates from attacking him. Dahmer had stated in his will he wished for no services to be conducted and that he wished to be cremated. In September of 1995, Dahmer's body was cremated and his ashes divided between his parents. And that, my friends, is the fine story of Jeffrey Dahmer, a great Wikipedia entry to read to your children before they go to bed.
Weather next.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
Whoa.
It's a lot. It is a lot to unpack. And, you know, I guess in this last chapter, when he's convicted, tried, and eventually murdered, I have to wonder... And I don't understand. I do not understand how another human being can still stand by another human being who does stuff like that, whether it's a parent, a sibling. I just don't. That one to me is unfathomable. I don't understand how you could continue that relationship no matter what. I mean, that if my kid ever did something as horrendous as that, it's done. There's what is the saving grace there? What is the what are you doing for yourself? Because I know sometimes there's the argument of, well, you have to have the relationship, or you should have the relationship to the horrible individual for yourself, for your own mental health. And in some cases, I understand that. In others, I completely disagree. And I think you're doing more harm to yourself if you're doing it for the good of the individual who did those things. There's a line in the sand somewhere, in my world anyway, where it's like, you've done too much shit, far less than murder in many cases, where it's like, sorry, you checked the box, and or I checked the box, and you're done, and we're no longer having any sort of communication or relationship. What's your thought on that with something like that?
I was going to ask you the question as a father, me not being one. Well, my child has four legs.
Yeah.
She's a dog. You have the two-legged variety. There's a line in the sand.
There's a lot you can forgive, but that the murder, the Jeffrey Dahmer type shit. No, there's no forgiving that. That there's no way in hell that would ever be forgiven, or there'd ever be a relationship or any sort of relief wanting to be brought to someone who would do something like that. I mean, there's things where there's accidental, you know, not necessarily, you know, accidental homicides and things like that. But if you're talking strictly, you found out your kid did all this shit and it completely admitted to it. No, what the fuck? I don't understand it.
I think the best way to describe it is there's just some situations in life that you have a suggestion, or you would put it into, well, if this happened to me, this is how I would deal with
sure.
it. But then there's some things where absolutely no idea how if I have children, they grow up, they kill 15 people.
Are you visiting weekly? Are you doing phone calls? I mean,
I would stay in my child's life,
yeah.
whether they did that or not, because again, I'm fucked either way. So I can still see my sure. child until they get killed in jail, opposed to not.
That's interesting with the mom. Like, okay, there's been no contact there. And you see that typically like, oh, contact comes back when they become famous for like being a celebrity for doing something good. Now, oh, holy shit. Look at all the stuff he did. He's in the news.
I didn't know that you ate livers too.
Yeah. It's like, oh, let's rekindle this.
I have turkey giblets. You have human hearts. It's essentially the same.
I don't understand it. I do not understand it. And like I said, to each their own, that's hashtag my truth on how I would handle it. But you are all welcome to your own as well. And you can say I'm crazy for feeling that way, but that's how I feel. Another thing that I thought was interesting was, and this is, you know, touching on the religious thing where, you know, he became born again and all that. Okay. Well, here's my argument of that. So let's say we all get up there and we're dead and we go through the pearly gates and you see goddamn Jeffrey Dahmer fucking wandering around up there. Seriously, we're going to deal. Jeffrey Dahmer is cool to be wandering around heaven. But we're going to judge all of the folks in many versions of Christianity, not all, but many, depending on your denomination. But we're going to be crazy judgeful of the sexual preferences of people and damn them to hell. But we're cool with the idea that Dahmer is hanging out up there. Now, again, this is just how you interpret religion. But some of the version that thinks Jeffrey Dahmer can make it there, I'm sorry. That's not fucking computing in my mind. And I'm not anti-religious or anything. I'm anti the fact thinking that this is an okay thing. And I know it says, you know, you can be forgiven for anything or whatnot, but there must be fine print somewhere that didn't make it into the Bible. Where it's like, and by the way, if you're Jeffrey Dahmer someday, because we know you're going to fucking happen, this excludes you. You can't be forgiven for this shit. There's just a sense of evil with some people that to me, there's just no correcting, and there's no forgiveness for. And I
think there is a situation in that regard where that is why there is there's a hell, and that is why I think there is the devil. And I think what I'd like to think is heaven is more than just a waiting room mm-hmm. in a doctor's office. It's a vast place. So even if there are the lesser deserved people in heaven, that there may be off in the distance, far, 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 far away. Maybe like a hell light.
It's
where
like,
you're not straight up in heaven. You're not in the great place. You're not in hell, but you're off in maybe like a bad neighborhood.
You're kind of like
where maybe somebody could lure you to their apartment for, you know, sex, and then they eat your heart. So you're over there, and you're not in hell, but. There you have it.
Yeah. So you've just kind of invented your own version of religion right there on and how you're defining everything.
It's a situation where what is very boring and very simplistic is if somebody has an opinion or a view, mm-hmm. that's awesome.
Sure.
And I can have an opinion or a view, and that's awesome.
Sure.
And we can respect each other to understand that you're you and I am me. But that's boring. It's, hey, I'm going to think how it is and you're going to agree with it because mine's better than yours. So,
and if not, I'm going to never speak to you for the rest of my life. So fuck off. Yeah, exactly.
So fuck off. but I'm not just going to tell you that in the sense of not telling you that and ignoring you. I'm going to comment on all of your social media platforms. Fuck off with a PH, because if I use an F, Facebook's going to shut me down because I can't swear. But no, it ultimately, I think there is and there always will be, even though what was outlandish and holy fuck in 1962 mm-hmm. is just common day here in 2020, there's always going to be a metaphorical fishbowl of holy fucking shit. We have no idea how to react or what we would do in this. There's always going to be that grab bag, that clearance bin.
Sure.
And I think until it happens in our personal lives or to ones we love or to family members, we have opinions of sure. hypothetically how we would do it, but I have no fucking idea. So
sure.
there you go.
Now, I completely agree. It's really a matter of here's what I would do if I was there, but without actually being there other than reading the Wikipedia entry, it's hard to know exactly how we would place ourselves in those situations. One hell of a story. That wraps up this episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. For Sean, I'm Tony. Thank you for listening. Be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform it is you listen to us on. New episodes every week of The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores. You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget, so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores. Think about the last time you had a cancel subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores. You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores. Think about the last time you had a cancel subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.